All right, my name is Damon and I am an alcoholic. What that means for me is alcohol is not my problem. You know, I quit drinking a number of times. Anybody else here quit drinking? Did it get better? No, see, it didn't get better. It's the amazing thing about this program is it's a kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet that teaches me how to respond appropriately to whatever situations in life. What I found out something very amazing is the circumstances in my life have absolutely nothing to do with the quality of my life. And that took me a long time to... At first I thought it didn't have a lot of effect, but I realize now it has absolutely no effect on the quality of my life. And really this whole thing is about the quality, isn't it? You know, I didn't want to have circumstances to be just the way I wanted them to. I really wanted to feel the way I thought I was going to feel when I got circumstances just the way I wanted them to. I drank to change the way I felt. And when I finally came to a doctor and told him what was going on, one of these kind folks in the medical profession, and he said, "Oh, you're self-medicating. You know, isn't that the truth? You know, I want to feel this way. See, I got to go feel this way. I feel this way. I got to go do this." And how many people were here last February? Because I told my story here last February. Was anybody? You were there here as well? And V, of course, thank you. And, oh, you were there as well. Great. I've actually got some of the CDs from that talk, and I was listening to it. And I think I'm going to do like Star Wars Part 2. You know, because that's available if you guys want it. And it talks about a lot about how I got into the program and what my drinking was like and all of those things. And I didn't talk a lot about being in sobriety. And also I touched upon the traditions, but I didn't dive into them a lot there. So where I kind of left it off is my sobriety date is August the 10th of 2004. The nature of my drinking was that during the 80s, I was actually like the designated driver. I was a guy who could drink non-alcoholically. I drank a little bit, I felt out of control, and I stopped. But then I crossed the line in the early 90s. And I began to look at what was wrong with my life, what was wrong with my wife, what was wrong with the job. I went from optimism to pessimism. And then I started getting pleasure by sneaking around, going to strip joints and all kinds of different places, because I really wasn't getting enough at home. This disease is so much about not enough, isn't it? You know, the world's not treating me right. I don't have enough stuff. My family should, you know, all of these different... It's almost victim status, really, isn't it? You know, one of the great philosophers of the 20th century was Curly from the Three Stooges. You know, I'm a victim of circumstance. I was a victim of circumstance, you know? You know? And that's the other great one from the 20th century was Austin Powers, and he gave you the answer. He said, "Oh, behave," you know? And I like this one question for an alcoholic is, what would a grown-up do, you know? Because I wasn't acting like a grown-up. I'd gone back to the way I was sneaking out of the window when I was 12 years old to go wandering around the neighborhood. I smoked cigarettes for 8 to 10 years at the end, and my wife didn't even know it. When it rained, I'd hang my head out the window and smoke the cigarettes there. What would a grown-up do? You know? So I crossed the line, and I started sneaking around. But I'll tell you what. I listened to a lady on TED.com. I don't know if any of you have gotten into TED. It's an amazing site about some really great talks, and there's a lot of things in there that have helped me in recovery. Bill told us to be quick, you know, to find out where religious people are right, and also to look around, because this program is really built on a solid foundation of truth that's really recognized around the world. Bill assembled it, assembled it very much so it works for me. You know, works for the alcoholic. But at the core, if it wasn't truths of the universe and it was just special truths for AA, I don't think it would work. So, but this lady was talking about, there's two, she did this massive research. She's an MIT graduate, and she does this special research. And what she does is she goes around, and she gathers up all these stories, and she comes up with trends out of people's stories. And she'll do 1,000 stories in order to get these trends. And she came up with this one thing. She noticed that there's two kinds of people. Actually, I heard a guy say there's two kinds of people in the world, those who break the world into two kinds of people and those who don't. But that's, you know, this was one that said there are those people who have a sense of well-being, and there are those people who want to have a sense of well-being. And the sense of well-being that this is what she said. She said, these people who have a sense of well-being are okay with being vulnerable. And the people who don't, okay, have two things. They have shame and they have fear, but a very special kind of fear, and that is a fear of being found out about what they're shameful about. Now, it talks about in the big book that an alcoholic leads a double life, right? We want to enjoy a certain reputation we know we don't deserve. I came in, and I was like the guy's sponsor. You know, the guy came in, he told the sponsor, he said, I feel so guilty. And the sponsor said, well, you are guilty. You know, I was guilty, you know, as charged, of not living based on principles that my mom taught me how to do and my dad taught me how to do. And Walt Disney movies taught me how to do. I mean, I knew enough about how to have a happy ending. Haven't you seen happy endings? You know? But I wasn't taking the kinds of actions that could lead to a happy ending. But you see, what this thing about shame is an entirely different thing. Shame says that I am a bad person. There's not a capability of finding goodness within myself. And I wanted, you know, I was a guy who had come up through the corporate world, and I was working with Fortune 500 companies, and you know, I remember the old commercial, remember that one? Never let them see you sweat. You remember that one? You know, and there's a lot about reputation and my relationship to my reputation today that has changed so much, you know? What I think you're thinking of me right now is not what you're thinking of me. You know? So for me to try and manage what I think you're thinking of me is crazy. You know? And how much of that was I doing? And then I would think, I thought my opinions were facts, that the way I believe the world was the way the world was. I found out that my opinions are not facts. I found out something even crazier. All of my facts are opinions. Except one. And that one is amazing. It says, I am. There's a story of an old Chinese monk, and he dreamed he was a butterfly. And he woke up the next morning and he said, how can I tell I'm not a butterfly dreaming I'm a monk? And it's astonishingly difficult to disprove that, because everything I get in the world is through my senses. And they're unreliable. I wrote a poem about leaves are not green. Literally, the light hits the leaf absorbs certain photons, and it rejects all the rest of them. And so all the photons I see coming at me, bouncing off that leaf, are what the leaf is not. Bill has another way of saying it, a whole lot simpler. Page 164, we realize we know only a little. Now, here's the neat part about it is, I used to think other people knew and I didn't. In the promises, it talks about a new freedom and a new happiness. And the new freedom is to realize, not only do I not know, but I don't have to know. You know? What's really neat today is especially this freedom from the question why. For 9 years, I've done the jail meeting at the Cobb County's finest gated community. And one of the things I've noticed is those guys in there have a lot of time on their hands to ask the question, why? And I was reading two German philosophers, Immanuel Kant and Arthur Schopenhauer. And you have to kind of do them together, because one started out and Schopenhauer kind of finished it up. And they kind of discovered Eastern philosophy before it got translated into German. It's kind of crazy. It came all the way around through all of this different Western thought and everything, and they came up with some of these neat conclusions. Then they got the Bhagavad Gita, which is the Hindu text, and they began to see the Buddhist works and the Taoist, Tao Te Ching, and all these different, and it's the same thing. And one of the things they found out was this concept that science seeks for a cause for everything. If everything has a cause, then that cause has a cause, and that cause has a cause, and those causes have causes, and therefore there is no cause. And he said the mind can just not wrap its head around that. It's like coming to a brick wall in space. What's on the other side? I'll give it to you more. Let's go down to earth with it, okay? My kids, why do we have to go to school so you get an education? Why do we have to have an education so you get a job? Why do we have to have a job so you can make money? Why do we have to have money? Well, let me see. It was the failure of the barter economies in the history of mankind. Well, why did they fail? I don't know. I wasn't there. You understand? So when I come into the program, I wanted to know why I was an alcoholic. I wanted to know why. I wanted to know why. And I drive people crazy asking why. You see, there's not a chapter in the book called Why It Works. Because I don't know why it works. This is a crazy program. You sit down and you write on it. You take some columns and you get a pencil and you start writing stuff down, and then you pray a little bit between and you say this prayer and that prayer and that prayer and this. And people who do it have astonishing transformations in their life. And everybody experiences it, and some do and some don't. And I see these guys in the jail and they have months and months and months to figure out, and I tell them, wrong question. There's a little book out there called QBQ, The Question Behind the Question, and it's a business book. And it says there's inappropriate questions. And they kind of match up with the program. The inappropriate questions are why and who. For me, that meant who do I blame? You know, whose fault is it that this situation is this way? Which is just another why question all dressed up, isn't it? You know? Now, what should be is how attached to the word I, you know? Or what attached to the word I, like what can I do to help improve the quality of this situation? If I'm knee-deep in mud, the question isn't why am I in the mud? The question is how do I get out of the mud? Or if I'm stuck here, how do I become okay with being stuck in the mud? You know? So what a lot of this program is about, it is about a complete psychic change. It's about a personality change sufficient for recovery. It's about profound alteration in our reaction to life. In Carl Jung's, in the piece that Bill talks, that he kind of imagines what Carl Jung is saying to Roland Hazard, he says, the ideas, emotions, and attitudes of these people was suddenly cast to one side, and a whole new set of concepts replaced them. This is not something you're going to find on aisle 4 at Walgreens. This is something where I've got this building. Think about it this way. What's the greater number? The number of cubic millimeters in this church or the number of habits that you have? And habits are not bad things. I couldn't live without them. Certain people have certain mental, brain damage, and they can't. They lose all ability to make or form habits. I mean, and they are completely incapacitated. The question was, do I have good habits or do I have bad habits? What's the quality of my habits? See, I would have certain habits about how to respond to the way I thought you were treating me. I'd have certain habits about the way to respond. And I'll tell you what, one of the great pieces of literature in here about how to respond appropriately is on page 99 of the 12 and 12, called the St. Francis Prayer. And this is what I would call one of the kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet in this program. And there's an interesting thing about this prayer and how I use it in my life is when I first heard it, I was in a 12 and 12 meeting, and there's a gal, and she looked and she read the prayer, and she went, wow, that's a hard prayer to live by. And all of a sudden, it struck me. No, living not by that prayer is a hard way to live. Now, the prayer is structured almost like four squares. Think about it like that, a top and a bottom with a left and a right. Okay? It's all in a paragraph form. It's all scrambled together. And one of the things I did early on was to write it back out with a left and a right-hand side. So it says, under this condition, this is the appropriate response. And let's see how it works. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace. That's the end goal. It tells us in the eighth step, in the 12 and 12, amazing thing, it says, learning how to live in the greatest peace, partnership, and brotherhood with all men and women of whatever description is a moving and fascinating adventure. You know, not getting what I want is a moving and fascinating adventure. You know, not, you know, finally getting sober so I'm sober. No, living in the, you know, learning how to do that. So when I'm around tough people that get along, I should enjoy the learning how to get along with tough people. People do not go to the gym and lift paper clips, right? You go and you lift the heavy weights. So actually, I've found out that a lot of my growth in this program is when I've gotten around difficult situations and then used this prayer and then seen the power behind it for the purpose of increasing the level of peace in the people around me. I get it by reflection. Improve it, help you, and I get it by reflection. Make me a channel of that peace. And this is not a bucket of peace, okay? This is a pipe tapped into the Pacific Ocean. Kind of peace. See, I'm not going to run out of it. And this is how I do it, that where there is hatred, I may bring love. Now, hatred is looking for the bad in someone. I'll tell you, because this thing really comes down to stories, where not just theory, but stories. My daughter is, when she first... She first met this guy, you know, and she wanted me to, and he wanted to basically tattoo her whole body, which was not my idea of what she was going to be like when I held her in my arms at the hospital, you know. But I, you know, this program tells me what I need to do is I need to try and see what she sees in him, rather than me trying to prove why he's not the right person for her and protect her. To try and be a channel of peace. And when I met him, actually, he had more time in sobriety than I did. He was in a thing called Straight Edge or something like that, and you know, he had dropped all that. Since then, in fact, he went back into it, and my daughter and he have been separated now for some time. But they have a son now, my grandson. There's something I heard in this program by a guy named Keith Lewis, and he said there's a thing called covenant relationships. And a covenant relationship is, I don't care how hard you want to break it, you cannot break it. He will always be the father of my grandchild. Even if my grandchild were for some terrible reason to die, we would still have that relationship. So now the question becomes, what's the quality of that relationship? Okay? What is the so? I've told him. I said, "I'm there as a resource for you." Now he's had some amazing. His dad looked like everything was going to go great. Had this great job and all this other stuff. All of a sudden, he winds up front page of the Cobb County newspapers and also made national headlines. He's now in prison for the rest of his life. He now no longer has a dad. So when he needed money to try and get on his own feet, he wants to be a comedian. It was funny, he was taking nursing because his dad was kind of in the health field. He was going to go into nursing and he lost his job at the hookah shop. And I said, well, you know, if I was going into nursing, I'd go around Northside Hospital or something, and I would try and get a job there. He says, yeah, but I don't want to be a nurse. I said, well, life's too short not to be doing what you want to do. What do you want to do? He said, stand-up comedy. You know, that was not going to be the choice of who I wanted my, it's not my, again, but Bill talks about our little plans and designs, right? You know, and these are my little plans and designs. What I need to do is, I find out today, I don't really have an agenda. I'm helping a lot of other people with their agendas. You know, and I really am. If you really look at it, that's what we're doing, aren't we? Just all different. And I find out that that's a really neat deal, because when I help other people with their agendas, I wind up getting everything I need. And it says 552 in the big book, one of my favorite little spots there. It says, this great experience that released me from the bondage of hatred and replaced it with love is really just another affirmation of the truth I know. I get everything I need in Alcoholics Anonymous, and everything I need I get. And when I get what I need, I invariably find that it was just what I wanted all the time. So I don't need to go struggle to get what I need. What I need to do is help others. And I always get what I need. I'm swimming in abundance of what I need. So the Catholic version of this prayer is very interesting. It changes the words a little bit in a neat way. It says, where there is hatred, may I sow love, like sowing seeds. Another story. This is where the rubber meets the road. I am a consultant, and I'm actually like the CIO for the entrepreneur. And in this one company, there's two different programmers who are working, off-site, around the area, and then I'm kind of coordinating what they're doing. And one of them, I sent him a text as saying, this is what we need to do in this particular policy of handling a database structure. And he sent back something in great, in big red letters that said bullshit, and he copied the owner, of the company and all this, and it struck me. And today I can still have the arrows stick in something. It's generally a mask I'm wearing. A lot of times people will shoot the arrows, and I'll go, hey, here's your arrow. When I'm spiritual, it's kind of. But when it sticks in some mask I'm wearing. There goes a reputation again, right? Carl Jung, the great psychologist, he came up with a concept called persona. And in persona, he was one of the three great psychologists of the 20th century. He's the one who did research in Africa. And he would go see the tribes dancing around the fire after the hunt. And one would put on the mask of the hunted beast, and another the lightning god or the mountain god. And he said a great question. He said, who's wearing the mask? The persona is this front that I want to put on. I go in as the customer. I put on a customer thing. I go in and I'm got a new client or something, and I want to try and present myself real well so that I'm controlling and managing what other people think of me, which is an impossible task. And yet it becomes very, very easy if I think great thoughts about you. If I'm loving you, if I'm looking for what's good in you, I don't have to worry about my reputation. Because my reputation will be of a guy who looks for the good in other people and becomes a channel of peace. So anyway, the owner comes out and says, hey, what's going on with Bill? And I said, he's a professional. He really is passionate about doing the right thing for you. See, I took it instead of saying he's a nutcase, or whatever he goes, I told him what was good about him. I sowed good. I threw the seeds, and I said the thing to the most important person to him in that relationship, and I did not try and defend me. That is not the behavior I had when I came in here. Listen to the first CD. Okay, that was not my MO. But I found out, the next day he comes over there, and we're in the back seat of the car getting the owner's driving us over for lunch. And I look over at him, I say, hey Bill, I got to admire a guy who can put bullshit in big red letters in an email, And he laughed and he said, yeah, I had a good time with that. And we talked about it. We came up with a compromise because he had a good point and I had a point I wanted to make, and we met in the middle and we found peace. You see, the spiritual life is not a theory. So I'm saying, I'm not going to just theorize, I'm going to try and give examples, concrete examples of how I use this in my daily life today to live this spiritual way. Because ultimately, I got to trust that there's a power behind that principle called love that's going to take care of all the details. And it always does. This is not about believing in God. This is not about understanding God. This is about relying. Whatever I believe God is cannot be what God is, because my beliefs are real small and tiny compared to the universe. What my understanding of God, how big would I have to be to understand God? But can I rely on God? Well, I got a little dog. We just got a little corgi, you know, and that dog will rely on us. Does he understand us? Does he understand what my computer typing is all about? No, but he relies on us, you know? But yeah, dog is God backwards, right? Anyway. So I think of this, bringing love is one thing, but I kind of like the idea of sowing it, you know? If somebody is saying something bad about me, what I need to do is tell other people their good qualities, not the person who's telling me something bad. They're not going to believe it. I tried that before with Bill. It didn't work. You know, because I was using this tool. I was trying to change his mind about me. All I needed to do was to help other people understand him better. And the result's been great. And you know, the other thing that really disturbed me about that, I like the guy. I genuinely like the guy. He's a very interesting fellow. Says that where there is wrong, may I bring the spirit of forgiveness. This is a case where somebody knows they're wrong. You know, they're not mistaken. They know they're wrong. And I don't need to tell them they're wrong. Let me tell you, I'm married 35 years, and that's not a good plan. You know? That's not a good plan. You're wrong. No. I need forgiveness. And Sandy Beach, he just passed away. He really said, in any situation, it says in here, and it's 109, in the 10th step, it says, it's a spiritual axiom that whenever we are disturbed, there is something wrong with us. And he said, well, what's wrong with us? We're disturbed. You may be nothing else, but disturbed is a problem. And no one can reach through my ear canal and push a button that says disturbed. I have to participate. No one can piss me off. They can't. They do not have the power without me participating. Otherwise, I'm a victim. I'm back to Curly, you know. Victim of circumstance. So today, I forgive not because someone deserves to be forgiven, but because I deserve to be a forgiving person. And that where there is discord, I may bring harmony. That's interesting. That's not in any form in the Catholic version. I think it suits the alcoholic, though, great, doesn't it? Aren't we masters of discord? You know, you think about the families and the ripple effect we have on the families. What's neat today is by doing this, we have a ripple effect of peace in the community around us, not just among the alcoholics, but everybody. Whenever I do this, I get this amazing ripple effect. And this harmony. Harmony, strings, I play guitar, and strings can be vibrating, and they can be different sizes and vibrating at different rates, but they can be in harmony because they're matching up in such a way that it creates beautiful music. It doesn't mean I have to give up my identity to create harmony. Okay? It means I need to be in tune with maybe what's going on with the other person. That where there is error, I may bring truth. Now, this is where the guy is going to Florida and he's heading north on 75. I mean, I can say, I've been to Florida before and I got there by going south. Now, I don't say, you're wrong going north. I can say, you know, I can share my experience. See, that's what AA taught me. I love what Father Joseph Martin said. You know, I don't know if you ever heard Joseph Martin, but Father Joseph Martin said, the best advice I can give you, don't give any advice. If I don't have experience in it, I don't know what I'm talking about. My daughter, she'll call me up and she says, Dad, I know you don't give advice, but this situation is this and this and this and this. And I'll be able to go, and I remember to do this is because I sponsor guys. And guys I've sponsored, I've given them advice early on when I was sponsoring them. It didn't go well, okay? They don't tell you everything you need to know to give them perfectly good advice. You can't know everything somebody's gone through. And these little details sometimes make all the difference. Oh, you're married? Oh, that's a small detail. That changes the whole dating thing around, you know? You know? Leave these little things out, you know? You know, so I can't know enough to give advice to you. And I would be playing God if I was giving advice. So I can just say, hey, in a similar situation, I don't even know if it relates or not, but this is what happened. And I think that's the essence of what's been successful for me in sponsorship. Because I'm not God. And I got one rule of sponsorship. I'm your sponsor as long as you say I am. That's the only rule. You know, I'm not about firing people. I don't know whether that's a good idea. I don't know enough to know whether I should be doing that. I'm here as a resource. I don't get people sober and I don't get them drunk. I don't have that power. I have a tremendous amount of willingness and I can't give you one ounce of it because it's a gift. It's a gift that each of us is given. If you've got it, take it. If it's the littlest one, just hold on and nurture that thing. That is the grace of God right there. I don't know what made me so willing to do all these things with the CDs and the speaker and the things I'm doing in the service and doing the jail meeting. I don't know. That's a gift. In fact, everything I am is a gift. My very existence, I didn't pick my DNA. You know, the Greeks had this idea that in the before world, you got to see a partial movie of the life and you got to pick. You know, they didn't say the whole thing. You just saw a partial one, and then you picked one, and then they showed you the rest of the story, which that's scary. I hope it doesn't work that way. But you know what I'm saying? It's not like that. So that these two go together, that where there is doubt, I may bring faith, that where there is despair, I may bring hope. If somebody's in despair, I don't need to be talking faith to them. I just need to be giving them a little bit of hope. People come in here. This guy came in, and he was, you know, just and over to my home group, and I was chairing the meeting. I looked over, and I said, I'm glad you had a really bad year because I wouldn't have had a chance to meet you if you had a good year. None of us came in here having a good year, you know? And I think that's hope. That's saying all of us had a bad year. I had three of them in a row. They were not good years. So this is about the appropriate response to be most helpful. Bill says on page 77, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service. This is one of those things that does that. And it's the word fit, which is a now word. It's not a future word or a past word. It's a now word. What I'm doing today is helping the guy I'm going to be next week be better able to handle next week. That where there are shadows, I may bring light. You know I got them when I got them laughing. You know? And the other thing that I think has been the greatest light I think I can shed tonight for you is to ask you two questions. Who are you between your thoughts? It's maybe three questions. Who are you between your feelings? What is it about you that's unchanged since your earliest memories? There's a life essence, and there's no name for it, because then it would be in your thoughts. But you can see it. If you can see it, that is my ability to be aware. It's my awareness of my awareness of my awareness. It's my ability to see my own thinking. What are we doing in the fourth step and the fifth step? But we're beginning to look, write down our thoughts, go look at them again, and be awakening the thing that watches my thinking while it's going on. I'll tell you, I'm doing three things today on a regular basis. Okay, the first thing I'm doing is I'm changing the story I tell myself about what's going on if it's a negative story. Because nobody knows, again, the leaves are not green. Nobody really knows what's going on. The negative stories do not help out the people around me. The positive story, hey, Bill's a, you know, he's a professional. I changed the story I'm telling myself. I like the guy. That's why I'm deserved. I like the guy. I changed the story. And I do it in such a way that it adds to the quality of the lives of the people around me. That's number two. And the third thing I do, I could add to the quality of the lives of the people around me when I was drinking by not getting out, by sitting on the couch and doing nothing, you know, because I was putting out bad vibrations out there. But in this program, it also tells me in the promises that feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. Anybody here an English major? That feeling is incorrect English. It should be those feelings, if they're two. But if they're one, then when I become useful, self-pity goes away. See, that's why service work is neat in this program. It's all about fitting myself to be of maximum service, why I become useful. And the real honor, I'm honoring the Creator when I'm taking the gifts the way I was put together and I am returning the kindness back to creation for having created me. In my little Oxford Dictionary, it says that gratitude is the willingness to return a kindness. You know? And I'm returning the kindness to creation for having created me the way it created me. I have a certain way of putting concepts together. I'm speaking up here. I certainly have a knack for it somehow. I'm also tall. Oh, I'm proud I'm tall. What did I have to do with being tall? I didn't pick my parents. I didn't pick the place I was born. I didn't really pick the school. Everything I am is a gift. We're some of the most amazing matter on this side of the universe. We're sending out probes trying to find something like you. And for an alcoholic, for me, it was not enough. Sometimes I just love to look at my hands and go, that's amazing. You know, it's sort of like the dancing bear. It's not that he does it well, it's that he does it at all. You know? I don't say I do this well. I just think it's amazing I can do anything at all. You know, we're star stuff. It took exploding stars to merge together and fuse the, you know, atoms together to form the heavier elements that form us. We're star stuff. Products of, you know, evolution's got it right billions of years. If the Bible's got it right thousands of years. Still, it's a very, very long time. Well beyond anything I can comprehend. Astonishing. It says that where there is sadness, I may bring joy. I was looking for happiness. And the problem with happiness is it has a little companion called unhappiness. See, if happiness is dependent on my circumstances, the circumstances go away, I'm unhappy. I do have happiness with my grandson. If something happened to him, you know, the happiness goes away, right? If you take away the thing, joy is a different thing. For me, my definition of joy is that which is left when I remove all the things, the unhappiness. The absence of unhappiness is joy. It's a natural state of being. And Meister Eckhart in the 1200s, one of the great spiritual teachers in the West, he said, spiritual growth is largely a process of subtraction, not addition. When I start subtracting this, and you look at, you know, we're not trying to tell you anything new. It probably said one thing, and that is it's the first drink that gets you drunk. Make this very clear. I know today that if I took a drink, I would become a different person. Did anybody tell you, acted, you became a different person? That I know today. I will never be able to spiritually drink. I don't care how. And what's neat about it today is by doing these things, every reason I ever had for drinking, because remember, it was my solution. I no longer need the solution. Doesn't even come up. You know, in 84 and 85, you know, we cease fighting everything and everyone, including alcohol. Sanity. We've been placed in this position of neutrality. Because I've got a power greater than myself that takes care of all the little plans, not my little plans and designs. And I'm a participant in life. I'm not the director. I participate in all of this. And I get to move. I get to be alive for it all. It's amazing, as it took me a half a century to find this thing, man. So that's the first part, and it's the responsive part of the prayer. Under these conditions, probably a good idea to do this. If you really want to have the easier, softer way, try that out. The second part is the proactive part of the prayer. And it says, Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted. I have, when I was in college, I worked a year at a nursing home, and I got to see people who were looking back on 75, 100 years of life. Let me tell you what, it's an amazing thing to do. You get a real sense of perspective. Let me tell you, one of the things that happens, they jettison all the stuff they own. They realize that the more stuff they own, the more stuff they have to take care of, and they're just tired of taking care of it. Now, what do your grandparents or what are they give? You know, what do you give your grandparents for Christmas? You know, maybe a Goodwill bag, you know, to put all the stuff in. Do you know what I'm saying? And this is an ancient tradition in India. When a man reaches a certain point in his life and his kids are and he's taken off, he jettisons everything he owns and he's to go off and become the mystic, you know, wandering around with nothing. You know, to jettison that stuff that's weighing me down. My sponsor said he never saw a hearse with a U-Haul attached to it. So this for me, I really, by being with all these people and doing that. Now, when I got in the back end of the program, when I came in, I knew I thought it was the computers and all the stuff I was doing with technology. I wanted to go back into healthcare and do a little bit with that. And I got this, answered this little Bright News ad, and it was this thing for non-medical home healthcare. And I started taking care of an elderly couple at night, and on one day a week. And I would go over, and I would clean. In fact, it was funny. They did the interview at first, and this little lady, she's very quiet, you know. And she's sitting there. She used to run a cafeteria for an elementary school. She was born up in North Forsyth County, you know. She's a no mess around kind of gal. And I said, is there anything you'd like to know about me? And she said, yeah, I'd like to know how quickly you can go upstairs and clean the bathrooms. And I went, you know, upstairs. And here comes the daughter after me. Said, whoa, you know. But I got a chance then. And later on, by the way, she'd go over this. I was with her for like 4 years. And later on, they'd go over and do the biannual assessments. And she'd say, don't take away my daemon from me. Whatever you do, don't take away my daemon. But I got a chance to be there with them. And this was in November of 04. And in July of 05, they both got the flu. Now, Bailey was 94 years old, and he didn't recover from it. And we started going there 5 days a week as an organization. I could only go like three, but we were doing five. And I came there at 9:30 one morning, and the daughter was, and she was tired. You know, he's been getting up and down all night. So I decided, well, the best thing to do is sit and chat with him. So I listened, and there's the wife sitting next to us, okay? And she's sort of grumbling. Well, he just keeps talking and talking, you know? But he talked and talked for an hour and a half. And he told me stories like, he said, well, you know, I quit school when I was 8 years old to work back in the cotton fields. Said, we used to take the product to Gainesville, which is 20 miles away. And I can still hear him say it. Said, a mule goes 4 miles an hour, you know. So it'd take 5 hours to go over there and, and they'd stay overnight and come back. And then he talked about when he was a deacon of a church up here in Fair Oaks, and there was a homeless lady came by, and after the service, and they hadn't counted the money in the offering plate yet, and she came up and asked him, and he reached in, pulled a $20 bill out and handed it to her and went off. And one of the other deacons, after she left, said, do you think that was right? And he looked at him and said, I don't think Jesus would mind, you know. You know, what was important to him is about who he treated, how he treated the world, you know. That each day, you know, that he had been able to say when he laid his head on his pillow at night, job well done. Isn't that what it's about? Be able to lay your head on your pillow tonight and be able to say, job well done. And at 94 years old, he was able to look at the collective part of his life. I'm going to tell you something really that hit me. The amount of time it took him to remember 94 years of life was the same amount of time it took me to remember lunch with my daughter the week before. I don't know if you get that or not. But at that time in life, the past is the same thing it is today. It's just a story I'm telling myself about it. You know? That was the last lucid conversation he had on earth. We talked another 30 minutes in the afternoon. I was able to tell the family what he talked about at the funeral. To seek to comfort than to be comforted. I got great comfort out of that. When she died, I wound up being one of the pallbearers for her. It says, to understand than to be understood. And for me, there's a funny word, that understanding is, what am I standing on? You know, this, you know, what's underneath all of it? You know, trying to get down to, when my wife, if she's yelling at me, I mean, what's the real thing? I think it's because she loves me. You know, she doesn't like the way I'm bad. She doesn't like me talking to her on the phone while I'm driving. And I should be going, oh, you love me. You know, because that's what's underneath it all, right? And I could tell the other story about she's trying to manipulate, she's trying to control, but I changed the quality of the story, which is, oh, you love me. You know, or she'll say, asshole, and I'll go, Sarah married an asshole, Sarah married an and she can't do anything but laugh, you know. And it's neat stuff. The other thing about it is my wife, I used to complain, a lot of the reason I was drinking is the house, you know, she just had all this clutter in the house. I mean, there wasn't hallways, there was little places to walk through, boxes and stuff that are stacked up and dust on everything and all that. And I told my sponsor about it, would just complain, and my sponsor said, and this was back in August of 04, maybe September, and he said, wait a minute, how long did you drink alcoholically? And I said, about 10 years. She said, give her 10 years. I said, well, that's fair. It's extensive, don't you think? I mean, kind of extreme. What's funny is there's a guy who came through the jail. I was sponsoring him. He said, I got a problem. I said, what's that? OCD. I said, that's wonderful. I said, what do you mean it's wonderful? I said, I don't know. It'll be turned up. He turns out he's making a living out of it. He's cleaning people's houses. My wife kept wanting to get the phone number from him. Finally gave him the phone number. She hooks up with him. She thinks he's great. He was over there today, you know. I'm paying him money to take my advice. You know, that's the funny thing about advice. And I really didn't advise, it's more like, you know, hey, that's a good idea. That's a neat. And when I found out, and I thought about it the other day, I started laughing because it turned out to be almost 10 years to the day from the time my sponsor told me that they met. That's a big God, you know. And to finish up here, it says, to love than to be loved. It's more important that I look for the good in you. What you think of me is totally unimportant because I can't know that. What I think of you is life and death for the alcoholic. Resentments are the number one offender. They destroy more alcoholics than anything else. We have a code. Love and tolerance is our code. And that means change the story, try and find something good about whatever it is. And it says, for it is by self-forgetting that one finds. No, that's that thing between my thoughts. Forgetting that I've got the... We don't need to get rid of the ego. We need to get it in proportion. Bill talked about insanity as a lack of proportion, inability to think straight. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. When my motive is to be a channel of peace, when my motive is to try and add to the quality of your life, then I'm free. I'm free from the bondage of self, and I have these moments where I'm not thinking about me. And it says, it is by forgiving that one is forgiven. You see, I can forgive the guy I used to be because I'm not that guy anymore. We go back to complete psychic change. If I have a complete psychic change, a personality change for sufficient for recovery, I can forgive the guy for the same reason Jesus used on the cross. Forgive them, for they know not what they do. I didn't know. I might have known knowledge-wise, but I didn't know. Not like we know here. And it finishes up with, it is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. And I had, William James, who wrote The Varieties of Religious Experience, you know, he basically said that one of the common things about everyone who had a spiritual awakening is that they found God in the valleys, not on the mountaintops. That's why it's great news. You know, if you're struggling some, that's great news. You know, If you're struggling some, I think that's fantastic news, because maybe there's an opening. It says God could and would if he were sought. And I love little John the Indian. And he would say, I think you need to do some soughting. You know, I think we need to do some soughting. So I want to thank V again for inviting me back. I tell you, that's quite amazing to be invited back. You know, I really appreciate it. And thank you all for just listening and being who you are.